From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And a very warm welcome aboard the pirate ship at the Reeve Gauche and to the Captain's Table podcast, brought to you by Are You Not Entertained and our great friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies. I'm Giles Morgan. I'm not actually a captain, or indeed a pirate, but a vague ancestor of my family, Captain Henry Morgan, actually was one, and his family all came from Wales as well. For 30 years, I have been lucky enough to travel all over the world as a boring old marketing suit in the sports industry, which included having arguably the best job in the world as head of sponsorship at HSBC. Along that journey, I got to rub shoulders with the good, the bad, and the ugly from the world of sport. And having ditched the pinstripe suit for breeches and the red waistcoat and cutlass that befits a pirate captain, I set out to create this podcast where every fortnight I simply ask my special guests from the world of sport to share their own personal memories of being a sports fan and how that passion has affected and shaped their lives. Well, welcome back, landlubbers, and to another edition of the Captain's Table. It's been a month since we all downloaded together, and Dame Laura Davis was just a brilliant guest to have on board, and what a privilege it is for the Captain's Table podcast to have golfing nobility on the show. The menagerie of the Reeve Gauche continues to swell, and we're now joined by a beautiful Maine Coon cat called Cat. I got her because Bruce is pretty useless at Bruce the dog, that is. He's not good at catching rats, and Cat is. And the lower deck's absolutely infested. She's very welcome. I'm also really chuffed since we last spoke that the sponsors of this show, Loch Lomond Whiskies, have signed up for another year. It's so generous of them to stock the bar and keep all our glasses full, and it's hugely appreciated. Moving on, this week's guest is a Yorkshireman and one of England's finest Test cricket captains, and it's a real privilege to have cricket properly represented. His records are long and illustrious. He was a joy to watch bat, elegant and assured, and steered England to that famous Ashes win in 2005. He is Michael Vaughan. A very warm welcome to the Captain's Table. Pull up a chair and make yourself at home.
Thank you very much. I've always wanted to go on a pirate ship, so thanks for inviting me on board.
The crew are a motley bunch. They could probably have used your captaincy back in the day. I'm not much of a captain, but in any case, enough of this nonsense. This is a pirate ship, and we do have rum on board, which I could offer you, but you can see from the surroundings that it's slightly classier a ship, and we try and take the high road with all our guests. So our drink of choice will be Loch Lomond single malt whiskey as opposed to rum. And I can offer it to you straight on the rocks, mixed maybe with some on the rocks.
A man who knows what to do.
And do you like whiskey peated or unpeated?
Peated, please.
Well, I'm just going to get, you can see Paul, my slightly gammy leg steward. He'll come on. Yeah, he's going to get you a drink. Right. That'll all be sorted. Right. Enough. Michael Vaughan, what was your earliest sporting memory as a young lad? And I mean, as a fan, as a young fan of sport, I imagine you love a lot of sports. Do you remember your first one?
FA Cup finals. The FA Cup Saturday, when the TV, I think the shows used to start about 10 o'clock in the morning, and it would go right through to the 3 o'clock kickoff. Didn't matter who was playing. I used to just sit in front of the television all day, ready for the FA Cup final, the famous Wembley Tunnel, Wembley Way, all the pictures of all the fans. You had the team buses being followed. There was always a camera on the team buses and then showing all the fans along Wembley Way. And then obviously the players on the pitch. Remember the Liverpool team in them awful white suits. They'd probably say they were cream, but they look white to me. you know, I just it was the Saturday every year that I couldn't wait for. Also, FA Cup semi-finals when they used to be at neutral venues. You know, none of this semi-finals at the Wembley Stadium at the final venue. That should always be kept as just for the final. But Sheffield Wednesday making the semis. We went to Villa Park in the 80s and lost to Everton. But going with mum and dad and my brother, those for me were the times where I remember sport more so than I do these days.
Did you want to be a footballer?
Absolutely. It was. It wasn't until I was around probably 13. I was at Sheffield Wednesday, and Sheffield Wednesday were showing a little bit of interest. And then on one Easter holiday, the academy director, a guy called Clive Baker, he did an X Factor style audition for the week. And at the end of the week, he was going to have his graduates for the next season. And I didn't make Tuesday from the Monday. He got rid of me on the Monday night. So I got in the car. Mum just looked at me and went, to be honest, and I've never really wanted to say this to you, but you're shit at football. You're pretty good at cricket.
Is that true?
So stick to the cricket. And that's where it was. I mean, I still try and play football now, even with a manky knee. I'm obsessed with the game. I just love watching football, whether it's Premier League, Champions League, internationals, local stuff, my lad playing. I just find football fascinating.
And was Sheffield Wednesday your team? Is your team?
Yes, yes. We managed to get to a Rumbelows Cup final in 91. I remember that vividly with mum and dad again, taking me down. I think it was in about row 7 at Wembley in the corner. And we managed to beat Man United in, you know, we were in the old first division back then. Managed to beat Manchester United. Ron Atkinson was our manager, big fat Ron. And then again, the cameras on the team bus going to the game. And we had Stan Boardman on the Wednesday team bus telling all the German jokes. It's quite amusing. But oh, great times. I mean, that's special feeling as a kid, knowing that you're going to Wembley.
Unbelievable.
And as I said, I just think these days they use Wembley too much and it doesn't feel as important. The final should be just at Wembley. The rest of the game should be at neutral venues.
Well, I agree with that. And the Challenge Cup Rugby League was the other thing. And those were the great occasions on the BBC that you saw Wembley in action in all its glory back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, Challenge Cup finals. I was fortunate when I played at Yorkshire that we shared the ground with the Leeds Rhinos. And Ellery Hanley was obviously a star player at Leeds in those days. I mean, Ellery used to arrive. I just remember he used to have the best cars. And he used to arrive with a mass of very pretty ladies in his car and then train and then just, oh, do you fancy coming to the Lawnswood? It was a pub at the other end of Leeds. I was like an 18-year-old. Yeah, yeah, Ellery, I'll come and join you. And he was always surrounded by some rather talented individuals, should I say. So as a young kid, going through the ranks at Yorkshire, having obviously Yorkshire teammates in terms of cricketers, and being able to mix it with the Leeds Rhinos. The one area I didn't mix it was in the gym. I always used to make sure that I wasn't in the gym at the same time as those Rhino guys. But I used to love Gary Schofield and Ellery, two amazing senior pros at the time who took... You know, they took time out to give us all advice. It didn't matter what sport we were playing. They gave us all a lot of advice.
And that was a real heyday of rugby league anyway, wasn't it? In that sort of end of the 80s, 90, early 90s, where the Wigan side was coming through, the Leeds was strong. It was all the star power at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it was generally just Friday night thuggery, wasn't it? That's what they did.
They did it very well.
Yeah, they used to just go out there and play. I don't know why the actual rugby ball was involved at some stage. They used to batter each other, but then shake hands at the end and no doubt nip to the local pub for a pint. That was pretty much what all sport was about in the, you know, the 80s and 90s. It's, I mean, my era of sport was very much around social. You know, I'm sure you've had plenty on the podcast talking about back in the day, but, you know, I don't think I'd ever change it. Obviously, there's more money in sport these days, but I look at the time that I played, it was very much old school. Where cricket was, you know, if you weren't having 5 pints after every single day's play, you were looked at that you were just a bit of a boring bugger. So that was the norm. And then towards the end of the 90s, early 2000s, a bit of sports science came into the game. And, you know, there's a lot more of the back room and data information about all the teams would be provided. And when I resigned and retired in 09, it was very scientific. And I think somewhere in the middle is about, I can't say that back in the 80s, 90s, it was professional. You know, there was a lot going on that weren't professional, but I think somewhere in the middle, you need a bit of the old school, but obviously you need a little bit of the science as well.
And who are the posters on your wall? Who are your sports heroes growing up as a young lad? Who
Kylie who Minogue. Idol?
Oh, I should be so lucky.
Yeah. Oh, Kylie, obviously Beefy and David Gower. Robin Smith was, in terms of cricket, I just admired the way that Robin Smith, Alan Lamb, took on the West Indies. You know, this was an era when I was brought up where England were getting now and again a pasting off the West Indies. They were the dominant force in the 80s. Then obviously Australia took over that dominant force in the 90s. But I used to just always admire Robin Smith playing that big front-footed forward defence to a ball that was coming at him at 90-odd miles an hour and then ducking and weaving out the way with that. He used to have the helmet with the Persplex sides on, so his face all open. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do that these days. So the courage that he used to show and the way that he was aggressive. I always looked at all sports and I liked players who were attacking. You know, not just the ones that could, you know, whack sixes and, you know, dribble and take it, but those that you could always see had a positive mentality that wanted to attack the opposition, you know, with their mind, with their game.
And did that affect you as you obviously became a player yourself, but also players that you either picked or interacted with? Is, again, on the field, those who had an attacking personality were the people that you would more gravitate towards?
Well, no, yeah, it was more your team, if you're going to be successful, needs that style of personality in it. You know, you also need, probably the wrong word, but the boring everyday type that just deliver, you know, the 6 and 7 out of 10 performances. But you do need these characters in your team that are just different, and they've got it in them to get 10 out of 10s. You know, they might not get it every game, but you need those style of kind of sports people to kind of throw fear into the opposing dressing room. You know, whatever the sport is, you know, before it starts, there's a lot that can happen in a mind, and a lot that can happen in your team's mind, and also the opposing team's mind. And if you've not got anyone that can kind of get them to start fearing what they could not achieve rather than what they can achieve, I think that's why I love all the characters in sport. You know, I love George Best back in the day. You know, I still now, if I'm bored, and you know, Lionel Messi, Ronaldo, brilliant footballers, but you know, I love going on YouTube and just putting in George Best. I mean, there's a lot about women on there. There's some good shots of him with a few birds, but you know, seeing George Best clips, it's remarkable what he did. You know, when you think about that the ball that he used to kick was about 15 kgs back in the day, wasn't it?
It was a medicine ball.
And what he could do, I mean, I just love those kind of sports people. You know, those that we kind of turn on. I mean, Tiger and Phil Mickelson. But Phil Mickelson is a great, but there's just something about Tiger that...
Magnetism, is complete, isn't it?
Oh, it's just, even just playing his local course and it's for charity. But everything about his... dedication, determination. He's got those. Even when he's just playing with his American football guy, he's got those eyes. He's desperate to win. He just
desperate.
Does not want to lose. It's a great, great mindset to try and get hold of.
And Michael, you've travelled all over the world playing cricket, obviously, and now being a very much a man of the media in the game. But you've probably watched a lot of sporting events in other, well, sports, cricket, rugby, football, whatever it may be. What's your favourite sporting stadium to go to as a fan, not as a player, but as a fan?
I mean, it's not the Augusta. There's, I mean, I've been very fortunate, as many have, to go to cup finals, whether it's cricket, rugby, football, whether it's Champions League, World Cups. I've been very fortunate to go to these stadiums with hundreds of thousands, and the lights are on, the noise. But there's nothing like walking through those gates.
Yeah,
Augusta. There is nothing beats that. I don't know. Maybe it's because you're handing your phone and it's just you and your pals, and you can't have any distractions. You know, you're not on Twitter and social media because you're not allowed to be. And there's this airy noise around the whole place that everyone's kind of looking at each other, going, "How lucky are we to be in here?" And you get that opportunity to go in the shop, and you're like a 5-year-old that's been given a license to go into Hamleys.
Yeah. And just I must have another toy. 5 t-shirts.
Yeah. And you buy all these t-shirts with the logo on, and then you get home and you go, you don't wear them because people look and you go, "Nob."
It's so true.
You get the umbrellas, you get the markers. And I've never, I mean, I was lucky to go 2 or 3 times, and I've never, ever kind of been to a sporting occasion and felt so privileged to be there as I was at the Masters for those 4 or 5 days.
And do you like generally to watch sport live at an event, or do you love watching on telly as well with a bottle of red and chilling out, or do you love the real live experience?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, football in particular, when the noise and the fans and the singing, it's a little bit tribal. Yeah, I love that. I mean, but the way that TV covers sport these days, you do feel like you're there anyway. Yeah. And there are a lot of times in sport where, you know, let's be honest, we're in a world now that you want everything done for you. It's quite a hassle to get to the game, stuck in traffic and being kind of abused on a bus or on a train. So, yeah, I think the way that all TV stations now cover live sport, you almost feel like you're there. They take you inside the dressing room and obviously the camera angles and the HD is so good. But you can't beat for me a football night when the lights are on and there's something on the game and you've got two sets of fans that are going at each other with a few songs. I still love that live experience.
And are you emotional? I mean, have you cried ever, or have you ever cried watching sport as a fan where something great's happened or you've been robbed of victory where you've kind of been reduced to tears?
Oh yeah, I used to cry all the time as a kid. If Sheffield United beat Sheffield Wednesday, that was me done. I used to try and get out of school for the week.
You know, he's pulling a sticky.
Yeah, I just couldn't cope with going to see my friends who were Sheffield United fans. You know, I just found it distressing. I look back now and I see some kids who are very similar. Obviously, my children growing up are at that age now where they can't quite get that you're allowed to lose. You know, they don't understand. Yeah. How dare your football team lose to your rival? Yeah. And that was me back in the day. I mean, I always just remember going to a derby and the nerves. I was that nervous watching. I mean, I don't get those nerves anymore watching because I understand that, you know, you just got to go with the flow and, you know, if it goes wrong, you just have a few more pints, don't you? Nothing can be that bad than losing a sporting contest. But when you're a kid, you don't understand. Yeah, you just don't understand that you can lose. So, great times. I used to absolutely adore.
And what's your half-time food of choice? It's a Monday evening.
Pie.
What's in the filling?
Just go for a meat and potato.
Meat and potato.
Meat and potato,
pie.
And then you get a brown sauce, and you just squeeze it on the top.
Job done.
There's not many. There's not many football grounds actually have good pies. It's the one thing I could ask to come out of COVID, when they suddenly start realising that they haven't got many fans in the stadium, and they're going to have to need them to get back next year. Get better pies. We'll all come back.
This is the new marketing strategy for every football club. Just get the pies in.
Yeah, especially up north. They like a pie up north.
Well, Jason Robinson said meat and potato pie was exactly what he'd have. And he's a Leeds man and then obviously went over to Wigan, but born and brought up. But meat and potatoes is his thing. I know you're a golfer. And Loch Lomond Whisky, as you probably know, the spirit of the Open Golf Championship. Lucky old them. I want to ask you a couple of questions about your own golf. yeah, everyone laughs at that point, unless they're professionals. Have you? How many times have you been to an Open Championship?
Open Championships. I reckon I've been to. I went to Lytham, I reckon I've probably been to two or three. St Andrews 1 year. When was that? 2015, I think that was then. I reckon I've been to two or three. Definitely.
And what do you think makes the Open special for you as a golf fan?
You're going to sniff the history. Very similar to when you walk through the gates at Lord's. You know, the event, I mean, particularly when it was at the, obviously at St. Andrews, that is the equivalent of what Lord's is. And I don't know, you can just sniff it. I've had, fortunate to have played the St. Andrews course a few times. And when you get on that first tee, it's exactly the same as taking guard at Lord's. You just look behind you and you just see age. You see a lot of old age and history and heritage and, that's why sport's great, because you get these arenas, you get these, these locations that just whatever era you're in, 100 years time, 200 years time, it's still going to be the same. Lords and St Andrews are going to be the home of their sports.
That's it. That's really interesting. You're the first cricketer I've had on the show so far. So you're going out to bat to Lords, and obviously you've got all of the tradition and history there, and the home of the game. Is it the same nerves as when you tee up at St Andrews for the first time on the first tee? That sense of all the greats have been here, and it doesn't—it's all in front of you, but you're just really aware that you're there.
Yeah, I mean, there's two. I mean, when you're at St. Andrews, all you're thinking of that first tee is don't go out of bounds. And I have been on a number of occasions left, bizarrely, just duck hook left, bouncing along down that road. But yeah, you just kind of look down at the serve and think, my word, the greats of this game have actually been on this tee box, smacking a ball straight down the middle. And here is me, Michael Vaughan, having a knock on the same tee box. The Tigers stood, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player. And when you take guard, it's not the taking guard at Lord's, it's the walking through the pavilion. When you go from the dressing room, down the steps, through the long room, and then out onto the hallowed turf, there's you don't probably think of it at the time, but it's when you get yourself on that honours board and you realise you're there forever. No one can ever scribble you off. They can't suddenly go, oh, you've been a naughty boy, we're going to take you off that honour board. Whatever you do in your life, and you could be the most awful human being of all time, you're still going to be on the honours board once you get on it. And I'm sure the same in golf at St. Andrews. If you can win the Open Championship at St. Andrews, no one's ever getting rid of that.
It puts you into a certain immortality. And I know you're a handy golfer. What's your dream pro-am team? It can be made up of professionals, mates, sports people, but you're the captain, you've got three picks. Who do you pick? And we'll go to St. Andrews just to make it, give it the open feel.
Well, Tiger. You have to have Tiger. He's just a freak of nature. I'm just in awe of him as soon as you kind of see him on the television screens. The other one I've just watched over the course of the last few weeks on The Last Dance will be Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. Again, I obviously knew he was a superstar, but seeing that documentary, some of the things that he did on that court. I mean, some of these sports people, particularly Tiger and Michael Jordan, when you get an Xbox or a PS4 and you start playing with your kids and you can play the greatest shots of all time and you think, well, it's just for the computer. And then you see Tiger Woods and you see him and you go, no, actually the humans can do that. They actually delivered what I can deliver on a computer, which is remarkable. So I go Jordan, Tiger, and I'd go Georgie Best.
Fantastic.
I'd want Georgie Best. Yeah, I want Jordan Tiger. Because what I like in sports people, again, Shane Warne, I love Warne, he's a good pal of mine, but I like sports people that get it wrong as well. You know, you look at all those sports people, they're generally on the front pages and the back pages, but they know how to deal with being on the front page better than anybody. Yeah. And when they need to perform and when they need to prove a few people wrong, they generally can because they're that good, they're that strong. And there's a fascination about, for me, in terms of sport, if there's so many of those types. You know, I'm sure you're getting beefy on the podcast. He, again, is a fascination for me, very similar to those three sports people, that they need the headlights. And if the headlights aren't on them for what they're doing on the pitch, they kind of, I don't know if they do it on purpose, but they find a way of getting the headlights for doing one or two things that are wrong. And that, for me, makes them very, very special.
Well, it's that wonderful expression that comes out of cricket, isn't it? That the ability to empty the bar. And Beefy had that. But, I mean, lots of sport, those type of sports people have that ability where you just don't want to miss it in case something spectacular happens, which is for a fan is everything.
Yeah, and they all tend to have these moments off the field that I think the normal person out there can relate to. You know, they can't relate to many of the girls they've been with because they're all supermodels, but they can relate to the fact that they're superstars. They've got this amazing talent, but you know, they do things that normal folk do. You know, I think that's why it's very hard to relate to a Tiger Woods because he's on the platform that no one can get close to, but I think people can, particularly when he went through those difficult times, went, oh, wait a minute, he is a human being. You know, I think that was a reminder that he was a human being and how he's come back from that.
And going just a little into your cricket career, but not your cricket career, I'm interested to know, when you started as a young buck and you're in the Yorkshire setup, were there players or people that at the start you were a little bit unsure of who've now gone on to be great mates, and you know how that sort of relationships change, particularly when you're young, you size people up and you get the wrong judgment on them. Were there people you started going, oh, I'm not sure, and then they've ended up being, you know, godfather to your child or something?
Not godfather, but I mean, again, back in the late 80s when I first went into the Yorkshire dressing room, it was brutal. because you're a young kid and you know, there was a first team dressing room and a second team dressing room. Bear in mind, you're one team.
Yeah.
So you had to knock on the first team dressing room to go in as a young kid, even though you're on the, and you'd be like, can I, and yes, come in, youngster. And they wouldn't call you by the name, but just be youngster. And, you know, they'd throw their laundry at you and say, go and do it, young'un. And you'd have to go and do the laundry. You know, bearing in mind, you know, 10 minutes later, you're out there playing against the opposing team as a team, supposedly.
Yeah.
There was just a, you know, a, yeah, it, there was a hierarchy in cricket when I first started. And
did that, was that good education for you to have that hierarchy? Yeah.
Yeah. And Phil Carrick was my second team captain. And unfortunately, he died a few years ago. But I look back at that grounding and that foundation that he gave me, and it was brutal. And he very rarely praised. He pointed the finger a lot, but it made me as a cricketer and a person, because you always wanted to aspire to be better and improve. You know, I guess when I started and the youngsters came in the team, I didn't want to be like they were. I didn't treat a young kid, you know, I didn't throw anyone my laundry and say, wash that. I learned a lot from the fact that the way that they treated me was just the era that they'd been brought through. They'd come through the 60s and 70s, where I'm sure it was a lot worse than they treated us. But, you know, by the time we were the senior pros, I think there was a few of us around the dressing room and realised it was time for change, and we had to, you know, really welcome these younger players into the side. So it certainly made me, but I look back and think, so the game would start, and if I got out, my job was to nip to the bookies to put the bets on. So I'd get given all this, right, go and put the younger up to Headingley, go and get us that bet on. 3:30, it's running, there you go. And I'd have to go up to Headingley with a load of cash, and they'd blame me if it lost.
And who was the most gifted player of your generation that perhaps didn't hit the big time and you felt could have, should have, but didn't quite for whatever reason? Was there someone who just was dripping with talent that just never quite worked out in a way that
Anthony McGrath is coaching Essex now. He played a few test matches for England, but he came through the Yorkshire boys and played for Yorkshire throughout all my career. And he was a player. You know, I probably captained him in two test matches, and I wanted him to stay in the side, but the selectors just didn't fancy him at the time. And he was moved out of the team. I still feel if we'd have stuck with him, he could have been a player for England for a few years. He's gone on to be a really good coach, won the title with Essex. I'm sure England will use him over the course of the next few years as well. But yeah, he's not a name that people will kind of go, oh yeah, remember him. But I think in the game, there's a lot of us always felt that Anthony McGrath could have gone on and had a long career with England.
And cricket's the ultimate game. You know, you're a batsman, you're facing all of the great bowling attacks. Obviously, you probably couldn't say this at the time. Were you ever intimidated? I mean, intimidated, yes, because a ball coming at 95 miles an hour is intimidating. But was there a personality that you, particularly when you were young, and probably the Yorkshire dressing, where you got, you really scare me. You are, I'm frightened of you.
Yeah, Curly Ambrose playing for North Ants. I was a 19-year-old playing for Yorkshire. I mean, you've got 6'6". His eyes wouldn't say morning to you. So I always used to say morning to any of the opposing team when I saw them. Say morning to Curly Ambrose. You just glared at me. I was like, oh, shit. And then before you know it, you're taking guard and he's charging in at you. And again, his follow-through would be an extra 3 or 4 yards longer because he's trying to intimidate a young player. The other one was Steve Waugh. Steve Waugh was... he was brutal. And he obviously didn't bowl quick. He was the batsman and captain of Australia, but he was just brutal with his mindset. He just made your life feel very small. You know, he'd always stare at you, make your batting 2 hours if you're out there for that long, you know, an awful 2 hours. So generally in cricket, if you're getting towards lunch, most captains are put on the part-timer, you know, just start, you try and get a wicket with a gentle off spinner or two, or, you know, someone that doesn't bowl often, you know, give him a bowl. Steve Waugh would put on Brett Lee to bowl 99s an hour bounces around the wicket, like the over before lunch. And that's the fucking last thing I need. I just want to get off and have my chicken. I've got to face 90 miles an hour around. And he was actually instrumental in the way that I captained. Because I looked at the way that he did it and the way that the Australians played and their mindset. I always thought, well, I'll try and trying. It's very difficult to copy, but I'll try and do similar things that, you know, when I, you know, if I ever get the job. So Steve wore as a kind of psychologist, in terms of he knew he could make you feel very small by just staring at you. But those eyes of Curtly Ambrose, I'll never forget. And Wazim Akram as well. Wazim Akram. Waz was, he was mercurial. I remember Wazim. We played him at Headingley one year, and after lunch, he came out, but he had his trainers on. And I was batting with Richard Blakey, and Blake's hitting for 2 fours in the first over after lunch. And I've looked at him and gone, what are you doing? He said, well, he's bowling crap. I said, no. He's got his trainers on. Keep his trainers on. And after 2 overs, he gets hit for another couple of fours, and he just shouts, studs! put his stud back on and bowled us out in about an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
Now and again, you've got to be smart in sport. And if a legend and a great is doing something that you're quite happy with, let him continue to do what he's doing. Don't ruffle a feather.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And just quickly, away from cricket, what event have you not been to that, or maybe there are a few that's on your bucket list? Anything in sport that you would love to go to?
Super Bowl.
Yeah. A lot of people say that.
Yeah, Super Bowl would be one. I'd like to go to the US Open in golf. Been to the Masters. I'd like to go to the US Open. It always looks tough. What's that golf event with a stand with about 20,000 when they all get pissed?
The one in Phoenix, Arizona, the waste management. Yeah, that looks quite fun as well.
Yeah, I'd probably like just sit in a stand there for a few hours and just heckle abuse at the golf. Golfers have it easy. They don't get, you know, that
crowd. No, they don't get to play at the MCG, do they?
No, they don't get people, you know, singing and abusing them in the stands. You know, they get a, you know, they get a little bit frustrated if someone takes a picture, don't they? And they start really spitting the dummy out because someone's taking a picture of them on the back. So I think, bloody hell, try going down to Bay 13 at the MCG and try and catch a ball with them lot behind you. I couldn't catch anyway, but with those behind you, I was never going to catch it. It's in Phoenix, isn't it? I'd like to go to that one. Have a bit of a day out.
Have a nice day out. Oh, I'll come with you to that one. That could be quite fun. And is there a sporting hero that you've never met, that alive or dead, that you would love to have done or would meet? Just someone you'd love to shake the hands? Georgie.
Georgie Best without, yeah. Just, I mean, I live near Manchester now, and the stories of some of the old bars in town that are still operational, that apparently that's where he used to do his work. You know, and the bar's still set out in the same way, and they say, oh, Georgie Best used to sit at the end. You can just see him. Just see him just sitting there at the end and portraying everything that's going by. I'm sure he didn't have to move far. Pretty sure they came to him.
Well, actually, it's true. Before he died, he lived in West London and very close to where I lived. And we shared a local pub, and he was often there. And he was the nicest, most gentle man, who obviously had his problems and his demons, but had that wonderful Irish friendliness and charm. And you realise this is one of the greatest of all time. And as normal and humble a man as you could ever hope to meet.
Yeah.
Providing you buy him and bought him a drink, of course, which as a pirate was no problem. Yeah. Now, we come to the part of the show which I call the Captain's Broadside, where I ask you a sort of bunch of random but non-sports questions or fan questions at all. So I hope you're up for it. You're on the Reef Gauche. You can see the beautiful surroundings, the oak table in front of you. But we can take you anywhere your heart desires. We can sail this ship anywhere in the world. Where do I take you?
Barbados. Very good. Maybe down to Mullins Beach if you can.
Well, we'll see. We've got a nice anchor, so we should be able to get you close. You can swim in if not. And for our first night, I reckon it'll be about a 3 or 4 week sail. And so you're going to put up my company. But for the first night, you get to choose the menu. I choose the cheese. You get a cheese board on me. So you've got 3 courses. What's Michael Vaughan's dream 3-course supper?
Well, I think we'll go with prawn tempura to start. Mm-hmm. Have some prawns. My main course is going to be roast beef Yorkshire pudding. So. You just can't beat it. Done properly. It's still the greatest meal of all time. And what would I have for dessert? Do you know what? I'd just go jelly and ice cream.
Very old school. Love it.
Yeah, nice lime jelly. Nice creamy vanilla ice cream. I'm not that picky in my desserts. So I like to go back to what I was like as a kid. And jelly and ice cream was my favourite. So let's stick with that.
Well, Paul, the steward, well, he'll try not to screw that one up, but he should be able to do a nice lime jelly and the ice cream's delicious.
We also, Michael, give you a delightful ensuite cabin, which comes weirdly with a power shower, rare in a 17th century pirate ship, but go along with it. What song does Michael Vaughan sing in the shower?
Any Oasis. I like Little by Little.
Do you have a good voice? Do you have good lungs?
I think we all think we can sing when no one's around. And then every now and again, you do a bit of karaoke and someone films you and they'll play it back to you and you realise that you're absolutely horrendous. So, any Oasis, anything like that.
And do you remember your first concert you ever went to?
First concert, I went to the Human League. Living in Sheffield at the time, and they were obviously a Sheffield band.
Absolutely.
And I went to the arena, to watch the Human League.
Fantastic. And what was your first car?
First car was a Golf.
What colour?
It was white. And I always remember it was from Gilders in Sheffield, and it was a sponsorship arrangement through Yorkshire County Cricket Club. And it had Yorkshire County Cricket Club on the side. And I had it for 6 months, and the last day I was giving it back, and I crashed it.
Oh, dear. That's hilarious. And obviously, this being a pirate ship and a fine vessel it is, we have the ability to smuggle things, of course, because that's what we're supposed to be doing as pirates. If we could smuggle your most treasured possession, sort of inanimate object on board, are you someone who has possessions? And is there a single possession that you have that you'd want to be looked after for all times and put in a treasure chest and buried safely?
I guess I don't get too close to much that I couldn't do without it. I guess the cap that I wore when I lifted the urn, I've still got that in 2005. I think that's something that I don't really want to go without. So I'd probably have that England cap that I wore when I was having Budweiser sprayed on the back of my head. And
yes,
champagne an hour or so later. So
it stings, doesn't it? It stings as well.
Yeah, it's still. And by the way, that cap probably stinks as well. So it's not been washed, and it's in a frame. So,
yes. Hopefully, a sort of smell-proof frame. Look, I've taken up a lot of your time. We've got a long sail down to Barbados, so I need you to go and unpack your stuff, get ready for dinner, and I'm looking forward to the jelly and ice cream particularly. We haven't had that one. That is first for a pudding. Michael, you've been a wonderful guest. It is a real privilege and pleasure to have you on board the Reeve Gauche and at the captain's table. And as I mentioned, this is a classy pirate ship, and we're not going to make you walk the plank or do anything despicable. There's nothing that. We're just going to send you a special type of treasure as well, a bottle of 12-year-old single malt from our friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies for agreeing and coming on the show. It's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, what a brilliant companion Michael Vaughan was. Cricketers always have the best stories. Something to do, I suspect, with months and months of touring. Quite often, stories that aren't entirely podcastable, but Michael absolutely nailed it. Before we go, the lovely folks at Loch Lomond Whiskies are giving away a bottle of one of their delicious malts. In order to try and win this bottle, head over to their Twitter page at Loch Lomond Malts and to see how to enter. I have to be honest, I have no idea who will be the next victim to walk the plank. The show is now monthly, so check out my Twitter page at GilesMorgan71 and to see who's next. Please also, if you can, review, tweet and retweet the Are You Not Entertained sports podcast series. If you like this show and, of course, the others that we do, Goal on Goal, The Big Interview and The Groundsman, it really, really helps. So until we meet again, keep your hammock strings tight, your lanterns well wicked, and always, please always, feed your parrot. Goodbye. Thank you.